The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Krotowski. On this week's podcast, we're looking closely at why a 32 by 32 pixel digital icon designed for the UK government's Information Commissioner's Office cost £585 of public funds, and what the alternatives are that will save the taxpayer from this kind of expense for digital artifacts, like websites, in the future. Joining me to discuss this are Tom Watson, Labour MP for West Bromwich and former Director of Digital Engagement in the Cabinet Office, and The Guardian's digital media correspondent Jemima Kish. Welcome.
Hello.
I said digital a lot in the period coming up to this particular moment.
This is like a real world version of Twitter in the studio right now.
Is it?
Yeah.
Do we have to at one another and DM one another? If we DM'd one another, there'd just be silence, wouldn't there?
Well, the two of you account for a large proportion of my Twitter stream.
I'm so sorry. You know what's actually quite concerning? I didn't really think that I've been tweeting anything that's been out of the ordinary recently, but I've started to get emails from people that I don't know saying, I don't know you, but I follow you on Twitter, and I'm just wondering, is everything okay?
Oh, Alex.
Oh, dear.
Oh, thank you.
Taking your digital temperature.
I suppose so. Tom, how's your digital temperature at the minute?
Pretty wild at the moment. The great thing about opposition is I've got more time for Twitter, not less. So I'm probably tweeting too much and doing a lot of tweeting about phone hacking, which is familiar to The Guardian.
Retweet.
Yes, indeed. Well, very, very interesting as well. Well, elsewhere in the programme, we'll also be looking at a grassroots initiative that saved one of the UK's greatest technological assets, the research documents of the father of artificial intelligence, Alan Turing, and how a little change at Google has managed to shatter the page rankings of some of the world's best known and most credible resources. Keep listening to the next 30 minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. We start with this week's news. Google has made a few tweaks to its search engine algorithm in a way that's affected the page rankings of some of the world's most credible online resources, like, for example, the British Medical Journal. The adjustments, aimed at devaluing websites that recycle original content from other sources to boost their own position and search results, has affected some important aggregators and original content resourcers. Jemima, when did they do this?
This was late last week, and they made an announcement about this because I think they knew it was going to have quite a noticeable effect. Now, there were some sites who we call content farms, you know, people that respond to popular search terms and then pump out content to back that up to try and get lots of traffic. And it seems understandable that those sites would be penalised. But it did catch some quite good sites as well that were necessarily quite disturbed and understandably quite annoyed by this change, including Cult of Mac, whose editor was absolutely fuming about it.
Well, what's interesting about that, isn't it, Tom, that it doesn't really take into consideration the credibility of a lot of these other aggregating sites. So, for example, people talk about the Huffington Post as an aggregator. It has become a very credible news source. So what effect do you think that this kind of activity will have on people's attitudes to search?
Oh, well, look, remember a decade ago when Google was new and it was like magic. You type in a search term and it would find the website you were looking for. Well, that doesn't happen so much with Google now. I think they were a bit late on this. Their announcement was pretty big because it affected nearly 12% of all websites indexed. And they were doing it on the back of an increasing number of complaints and statistics that showed that their relevance to search, relevance for search terms was going down for their users. I think that's because they're dominant in the market. They've created an entire industry of search. They've got paid advertising. They've got a lot of mouths to feed, and they were slow to the party and had to play catch up when other search engines were sort of biting at their heels. So, you know, they can't win on this, but they've only got themselves to blame for not sort of constantly updating the algorithm and keeping people informed.
Well, what's interesting about this, of course, is that there is an entire search engine optimization industry that's grown up around this. And, you know, this is their modus operandi. This is ultimately what they are built to do.
Yes, and they don't really have that much of a right to get their knickers in a twist about this, because Google is an independent, as authoritative and as dominant as it is. This is an arbitrary algorithm. The whole point of this is that it's random. And for SEO specialists to get upset about Google making such a big change is kind of irrelevant. I mean, it's if they keep tweaking it, they keep trying to what they see as perfecting this to make it more efficient and more fair. And also the publishers have to, you know, they're very happy to go along with Google when it suits them and when they're, you know, number one or two or at least on that first page. So they've just got to take the rough with the smooth, I think. Isn't that harsh?
It's a dangerous game of cat and mouse, isn't it? Ultimately, because you've got companies who are paying quite a lot of money to SEO organizations to
it's a dark art.
Yeah. Well, because again the algorithm is completely hidden. For the purposes of serving the public, which is ultimately what I think Google's purpose should be when it comes to indexing the web.
Google's forums are overflowing with people seething with discontent about this. And it's hard to overestimate how troubled some people have been by it.
Of course, Tom, you don't want when you stick a search, when you stick a term into the Oracle that is Google, you don't want to have, you know, content farms coming back. So you as a consumer should be perfectly happy with this, even if, you know, Technorati or the BMJ or Cult of Mac aren't any longer your top results.
To be honest, I think the consumer is best served by this decision. I mean, and Google must know their USP, the reason they exist is because they do search better than anyone else. The minute they lose that reputation, the entire brand goes. So they've had to do this. And frankly, the clever websites will catch up. You know, they don't. It is a cat and mouse game. I think they'll just sort themselves out and be okay in the end. But, you know, when people were switching to other search engines because they weren't finding stuff they wanted, it's pretty bad for Google, really, when you think about it.
There is a trend, though, Jemima, for different types of information gathering online, you know, whether it's the social searching like Yahoo Answers or your Q&A sites like Quora, which has become a very popular site recently, and even, you know, the human parsed services like Mahalo.
We will increasingly see services like Quora and Stack Overflow and Mahalo and all of those services become more and more important as they become better and more comprehensive in organizing and making that information accessible. And the elephant in the room here is Facebook as well, which more for consumers rather than business, but that's a very important way of accessing information. Less sort of search and destroy, I suppose you'd say, and more kind of serendipitous searching for news and things, but it's a very, very important part of the information access experience.
Well, we're planning on looking at search later on in the year, so do send us your thoughts and experiences and ideas to us on Twitter at GuardianTW. Alan Turing is one of the greatest British computer scientists, instrumental in developing the computer science that eventually helped to crack the Enigma code during the Second World War at the Government Code and Cipher School at Bletchley Park. Turing was also an extraordinary logician and mathematician who put into practice much of the basic scaffolding for today's computers and artificial intelligence routines. However, a trove of his papers, historical artifacts, were due to be sold to an overseas bidder at great loss to the museum at Bletchley Park until this week. Joining us on the line is Dr. Sue Black, Senior Research Associate in the Software Systems Engineering Group in the Department of Computer Science at the University College London, who was instrumental in campaigning for the restoration of the Bletchley Park facility and also in keeping Turing's papers in the UK. Sue, welcome to the podcast.
Hi there.
Thank you very much for joining us. Tell us a little bit about the papers and what it is that you've been doing in order to keep them in the country.
Well, so some of Turing's offprints that belong to one of the codebreakers, Max Newman, along with the visitor's book from Max Newman's house, were up for auction at Christie's. And a guy called Gareth Harfordry spotted this after a tweet from at Bletchley Park on Twitter. And he spotted it and thought he'd start a campaign to try and raise the money to buy the papers for Bletchley Park. So they were up for £300,000 to £500,000, and Gareth set up a Just Giving account. But after a week, you got to £20,000, which is amazing. It's an amazing amount of money to get from the general public, but it wasn't anywhere near £300,000. So I was kind of casting around for ideas of what to do to try and bring in some more money. And I was at a talk at Nesta, Silicon Valley comes to the UK, and one of the speakers was Megan Smith, who's a VP at Google. And so I thought, well, look, I'll go over and see if she's interested in helping out, basically, in getting the papers for Bletchley Park. And so I had a chat with her, and another guy from another person from Google, Simon Meacham, just happened to contact me saying that he wanted to help out with the Bletchley Park campaign around the same time, and they worked to get $100,000 from Google to go towards the purchase of the papers. So that gave Bletchley Park about £100,000 going into the auction. And when it got round to the Turing Papers lot, the auctioneer said, and the bidding starts at
£165,000. Oh,
like,
oh, no, Sue.
Yeah. So I kind of started thinking, oh dear. And the bidding went on for about, it didn't it? It was very short amount of time, maybe 10, 15 seconds, it seemed. And then it was all over. But I didn't know what had happened. It was so quick. And it turned out that the papers hadn't met the reserve price. And so from them, several people have been trying to raise the money. And Simon Greenish, the director of Bletchley Park, has been speaking to lots of people trying to bring, you know, the gap in funding, and talking to Christie's and talking to the seller. We don't know who the seller is. Trying to, you know, negotiate for Bletchley Park to get the papers. And so, you know, that happened this week with an anonymous donor and the National Heritage Memorial Fund coming in with the shortfall. We don't know the actual price that they were bought for in the end, but Heritage Memorial Fund came in with a shortfall, and so the papers came to Bletchley Park. Hooray!
So Sue, what actually are the papers in question?
It's 16 of offprints of Turing's papers. So there are notes from Turing and from Max Newman on the offprints, and there's also the visitor's book from Max Newman's house. And Max Newman was a friend of Turing. And actually, William Newman, Max Newman's son, was there at Bletchley on Friday, so I got to meet him, which was wonderful. And he was telling us stories about Turing, because when he was a child, he knew Turing, because, you know, he was a close family friend. And Max Newman testified for Turing in his trial, you know, when he was persecuted. So some interesting stories from him.
Why did you feel it was so important that the papers remained in the UK, and specifically at Bletchley Park?
Well, I think we don't have very much of Turing left. You know, there aren't that many artefacts, because I think it was such a long time ago, because of the way he died, because he wasn't recognised really, maybe by a small amount of people, but, in you know, by the public or the government. He wasn't really recognised to the extent that he should have been in his time. You know, his artefacts have not been kept.
So, Tom, what role or what import does Turing have to the national cultural
Turing
economy?
Was not just a great intellectual, he was a great Briton. And what I think Sue and her team are doing at Bletchley Park is amazing. They not only put maths and logicians back on the map for the UK, they give hope. Remember, we've got computer science courses that people aren't applying for now, when India is turning out a million IT graduates a year. This guy has made maths and logicians cool again. And all credit to Sue and the work she does.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the Conservative government has been doing a lot of plugging of Tech City and sort of missing what's right under their nose, which is exactly what Tom pointed out, and that's our homegrown talent. We need to be doing far more to nurture the history and the culture that we have. Sue, when can we see the papers at Bletchley Park?
They're in for restoration and renovation at the moment, and I think later on in the spring we'll be able to see them. I'm sure we'll be letting everyone know when they're on display, so you'll definitely hear about it.
Well, Sue, we're going to be, we intend to come to Bletchley Park
cool.
in the future to have a look. Thank you very much for joining us, and you can read more on these stories and others at guardian.co.uk/technology. A rebranding exercise undertaken by the Information Commissioner's Office in July 2010 cost the taxpayer a whopping £40,000, according to a Freedom of Information request that Charles Arthur reported on last month. Amongst the more obtuse charges for the government department's new website was £585 for a 32x32 pixel icon. Charles met with Margaret Manning, CEO of Reading Room, a digital consultancy commissioned by the ICO to undertake the rebrand, to find out why her company charged so much for work that otherwise costs pennies, and why the government was prepared to pay. He began by asking her to explain why the favicon cost as much as it did.
Creating that icon would probably take in the region of a couple of hours. What do you have to do?
Hours? Really? Hours?
Yeah, About half a day. Well, a couple of hours.
Someone doing it for themselves on their own web page, it would take really hours. I mean, I've heard people saying minutes. I've got to say, I've tried it myself, and I've managed minutes as well.
Okay. Well, I think when you're taking, I think a lovely comment on the on your article, on the Guardian article, actually went through all the stages you'd need to go through. You can just shrink something down and make a fab icon in very few seconds if you want to, but in actual fact, finding all the graphics, making sure that the graphics are right, checking it off with the clients, a couple of hours would more or less do that. What you then have to go through is a process of getting anything uploaded to websites, and that is a process. And I think what you're finding with this, and it's not specifically with favicons or ICO, it's more a general thing with government, which is a cultural conservatism, which is inherent in government processes, which don't allow government departments to tell the difference between purchasing a favicon or purchasing a fleet of Nimrods.
You would think then that the whole process that it had to go through, because I think it went from yourselves, you sent it to one company, which sent it then on to another company, which actually put it on the site and made it live, which then had to reflect it back to the intermediate company, which then reflected it back to you, that a lot of this could be short-circuited or at least could be stripped out.
Well, if you actually have a look at how government works, you find that in general, the protectionism can get quite out of proportion.
Protectionism of what?
Protectionism of the departments themselves from criticism, people from criticism. A commercial organisation will look at risk in a very different way. They'll look at risk and reward, whereas a government department will look at just and see risk and therefore will start protecting itself, which is out of proportion to the actual risk that they face. Just have a look at any open tender procurement process. Sometimes the procurement process, and in fact quite a few times in our industry, the procurement process itself can take longer than actually the time to do the work. And the worst case I've come across is an 18-month procurement process for one website, which involved over 300 suppliers.
So then what sort of cultural change do you think the government needs to make? Because, for example, we're talking here about, you know, it starts off with talking about a favicon, which is just a small file that gets uploaded to a web server. But obviously you can see that there is a question of risk there, that if you're allowing anyone to upload a file to a web server, then they could be putting all sorts of things in there, and you need to be able to actually to trace back and to estimate, well, what's the risk that actually someone's uploading a rootkit to the ICO web server and everyone who comes by there is actually going to get malware?
Well, if you have a look at the processes that are involved with our favicon, it could be a whole website being uploaded, or it could be something small being uploaded. The processes are driven by large IT processes. They're not driven by what we would call small, open source, fast run, agile processes that many companies are now following, particularly with digital. The government will tend to look, and it comes back to cultural conservatism and playing safe, it will tend to look at projects as how safe are they for the next 5 years. Now, when you apply that type of thinking, the big IT project mentality, to creating a Facebook page, you can see why sometimes what the outcome is hilarious.
How then would you suggest changing the culture? What do you think can be done to alter it?
In Australia, it actually is looking at digital as a separate way of working. So it's saying with digital projects, it's not like buying a major financial system. And it's going out, it's collaborating with innovators. And it's saying, how do we make these processes run better? And when you look at the eDemocracy Award for the most highly awarded person, that went to Kate Lundy in Australia, who's a remarkable innovator.
Sorry, what's her role exactly?
Kate Lundy was an instigator of a large task force that happened in Australia to look at government 2.0 and how the government could use social networking to cut its communication costs. They created a task force to look at it. That task force reported, and the task force was then disbanded rather than stayed as a large quango eating up money for the future. And that created processes whereby the Australian government could procure social media in a very cost-effective way.
But again, that sounds like you need to change the culture within the government. It sounds as though the Australian government has a different way of going about things, where it says, OK, well, we're perfectly willing for this to be different and for there to be some downside, which it sounds like the UK government, despite all the talk about big society and need to streamline and David Cameron pushing a lot, it sounds like there's not actually that will within the civil service, perhaps.
I would completely agree, and I think we've got an opportunity with the big government to actually start changing cultural conservatism. But simply putting cost control over the government departments is not going to do it. That will create a greater degree of fear and a greater degree of clampdown.
So then what are the things that you would say need to be done, just in terms of concrete actions that a minister could take today? Say Francis Maud. Yeah, given he's the man at the centre in the Cabinet Office.
I think absolutely start with Francis Maud. There needs to be a meaningful difference made to the procurement processes within government, and that is definitely the very first starting point. I think there needs to be a very big and open debate about how government uses agile systems of processes internally.
I mean, there have been examples where government has got things out really quite quickly. Tom Watson in the last government put out his Show Us the Better Way competition, where he encouraged people to suggest ways to use open data. There was the consultation, which Nick Clegg was in charge of. That was put up pretty fast and had lots of people suggesting ideas, including repealing the law of gravity, but we'll leave that aside. Government can move fast when it wants to on the web front. Is it just that there are little pools or puddles almost where it's effective and that there's no one who's able to make it spread out? Is that what it needs? Does it need David Cameron actually kicking people?
Reading Room was actually involved in data.gov and we actually created this site in a period of 3 to 4 weeks. It is possible. When you see government working very quickly, it tends to be that you have an innovator in there. You have somebody with a vision that is able to kick it through very quickly. And it has to be David Cameron. It has to come from the top.
That was Charles Arthur speaking with Margaret Manning from digital consultancy Reading Room. Tom, Margaret Manning was talking about needing something to come from the top, really needing an innovator to kick things through. At the moment, we don't really see people who are engaged digitally. So, for example, taking a look at the ICO, taking a look at this particular issue, the rebranding, what can Francis Maud actually do?
I think the three things that government need to make this work are the right leadership, the right culture, and the right skills. And the hardest to find is leadership, but ironically, I think we've probably got it with Francis Maud. We've certainly got the stamp of David Cameron's approval for this agenda. We had it with Gordon Brown. The difficulty is the skills base within the civil service is eroding. They've put a freeze on consultants. Lots of the tech guys were hired on consultancy contracts. They've left. And the culture is just dreadful for this stuff. I was near insanity by the end of my time as digital engagement minister. The net knows no borders, but the civil service are stuck in silos. And so what Francis has got to do to move this on, to have a big step change, I think, is be a total dictator. I think he should be given total control of the government web estate and he should wrench it by the throat into the 21st century. He could drive down cost, add value and make government websites more relevant if he's given that power.
Well, that would make him tremendously unpopular, but certainly there would be an effectiveness that would come out the other side.
Out of all the Conservative ministers I've met, he's probably the most charming. So if you're going to give anyone total power, it would be Francis Maud.
Well, and Boris Johnson.
Maybe Boris Johnson. Alas, he's busy trying to run London. Not very well. That's a political point. Sorry, Tech Weekly listeners. But he would also need to build a team as well. The one thing, the government would, and I'm sure the opposition would give him fulsome support if they broke their rule to freeze consultants. They need to bring in the best web people in the country, given the amount of taxpayer money they're spending on the web estate.
Does that need to be consultants? As we've said, there is a freeze on the consultancy. That's an economic decision that's been made. Why not, like the Science is Vital group, the Science is Vital team, who want to get more scientists in Parliament, who want to get more elected officials in Parliament, they've actually changed their tune now, and they're saying they actually want to get more scientists in the civil service. So if that argument is valid for that industry, surely it's the same for the digital industry and technology industry. But why aren't we seeing technologists going into that sector?
Well, we do hire technologists. We don't give them enough power in the system. We as a country hire technologists, I should say. And, you know, Mandarins, the digital stuff is just secondary or tertiary to their sort of big lives about sort of power plays in Whitehall. It's not, it doesn't, they don't afford web, you know, digital policy the status it deserves in government. And Francis Maude can change that, I think. And I think it's incumbent on all parties to give him support if he wants to make those big changes.
What are the realities of working in government when you have a digital agenda? You alluded there to your mental health.
you get no control over cost. I mean, every project I saw, in my view, was spending way over the budget. It's like trying to catch water between your fingers. You just can't stop people wasting money on websites. And there's lots of territorial fights. You know, when we were trying to close down websites because nobody visits them, and there was cost there. Middle-ranking civil servants were trying to keep possession of their domain name and all that kind of stuff. You know, I've had an appeal with the Information Commissioner. It's about to get granted to give me the list of every government website. It's not in the public domain. I'm told it's going on the data.gov website tomorrow, but it took nearly 12 months and a third appeal with the Information Commissioner to force the Central Office of Information to put this stuff in the public domain because it's so controversial. You know, people will find websites that nobody visits anymore, that are badly designed, inaccessible. There's a big problem here and it needs taking on.
How much money, Tom, really could be saved if the government simplified the procurement, the sort of commission, the tendering process?
It's almost impossible to say accurately, but, you know, finger in the air, I bet you could probably do the same for half the price. You know, I mean, some of these projects are staggeringly overcharged. Some of them are unnecessary. There's lots of content you could just stick on flipping Facebook rather than, you know, design your own website.
But then potentially you've got that ownership issue. You know, you've got the security issue of having all that content owned by Facebook, Microsoft, etc.
You kind of have, but lots of websites are public information websites. The problem with that is most civil servants can't get onto social media because they're banned by their permanent secretaries who think it's some kind of security risk.
But they also frankly don't engage with it. And I think we've got a level of understanding in this room and amongst our peers of what benefits these, you know, what benefits the web offers. But the general experience, I wouldn't say people in the civil service and elsewhere really do engage with that and understand it.
No, because information is power in the civil service, and giving it away is just kind of an anathema to them. It's really hard. That's where the cultural thing is hardest. That's, you know, I think they can get the skills base right. They've certainly got the leadership, but getting the cultural change is really the, you know, wading through treacle problem that Francis will find, I think.
Well, benevolent dictators and charming Mussolinis, digital Mussolinis in the future. You can find out more about this story at guardian.co.uk. That's it for this week from Tech Weekly. Many thanks to our studio guests, Tom Watson and Jemima Kish. Thanks also to Dr. Sue Black at Bletchley Park and Margaret Manning from The Reading Room. Next week, we find out what Mozilla has planned for the way we surf the web in its latest Firefox release. And we'll be giving you a sneak peek at what Jemima and I will be up to in Austin, Texas at the annual South by Southwest Festival. Yeehaw. The producer this week was Scott Colley. I'm Alex Kratowski. Until then.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.